you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Today I'll be talking to Curtis Acosta, one of the founders and lead teachers in the Mexican American Studies program within the Tucson Unified School District in Arizona. The program, which was created in 1998, was ultimately banned by the state in 2010 on the basis that it, supposedly, encouraged ethnic hatred of whites, encouraged hatred for America and the desire to overthrow the government of the United States, and promoted ethnic solidarity instead of treating people as, quote-unquote, individuals. But recently, a district court in Arizona ruled that the banning of the Mexican American Studies program was unconstitutional, a violation of the students' rights to receive information under the First Amendment, and also a violation of their 14th Amendment rights of equal protection under the law, because the ban on the program was motivated, according to the court, by clear racial animus, particularly the racial animus of state officials aimed at Mexican American and a larger Latinx student population. So in just a second, I'll be joined by Curtis Acosta. We'll be talking about the history of the Mexican American Studies program in Tucson, the court decisions, and the long legislative and political battle to maintain a radical pedagogical approach that was working to uplift the academic achievement of Latinx students within the TUSD. And to the extent we're going to be talking about educational equity efforts, maybe it's a good time to ask a broader question about education in America. After all, how often have you heard it said, education is the great equalizer? I, for one, have been hearing that all of my adult life. I've heard it from teachers. I've heard it from parents. I've even heard it from students who believe that the importance of education is that it allows us to bridge the gaps, gaps in income, gaps in wealth, gaps in household well-being, that it allows people who come from the bottom to rise to the top. If people go to school, stay in school, get a college degree, that somehow the inequalities that plague us as a nation will melt like butter. But the reality is, if we look around and pay attention, education has never actually performed that function. It's one thing to say that education could be or should be the great equalizer. But when I talk to teachers and they tell me that education is the great equalizer, they aren't making that comment in an aspirational future tense sense of the phrase. They're making it in a descriptive present day sense of the phrase, not as an aspirational comment, but as a descriptive comment, not about what could be or what should be, but about what they think is. And as educators, if you believe that the system that you're a part of is actually a great equalizer, you will never be able to serve the interest of those children because you don't understand the machinery into which they have been placed and in which you yourself as a teacher operate. Now, I know that to some this may seem very cynical, but listen. The burden of proof is on those who insist that education is the great equalizer. What evidence do they have for that? Because here's the evidence that says it isn't true. According to Labor Department data released in 2016, even when you look at folks who have college degrees, when you look at the racial breakdowns, even African American folks with a college degree are considerably more likely, almost twice as likely, 93% more likely than whites with a degree, to be unemployed. When you look at Latinx folks who have a college degree, they are 64%, almost two-thirds more likely than whites with a degree, to be unemployed. When you look at Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders with a college degree, they are 26%, or about one-fourth more likely than whites with a degree, to be out of work. When you look at folks who just have a high school diploma, the gaps also persist. So African American folks who finish high school, don't go on to college, but do indeed get their diploma, almost three times as likely as whites with a diploma to be unemployed. Latinx folks with a high school diploma, but no more, three-fourths more likely, 74% higher rates of unemployment. Asian Americans who finished high school but didn't go on to college, 21% or one-fifth higher unemployment rates than whites who finished high school but didn't go on to college. But that's not all. When you look at households whose head of household has a college degree and is white, the median net worth for those families is about $180,500. When you look at black households headed by a college graduate, the median net worth is only $23,400. That's an 8-to-1 ratio. In other words, when you look at folks who have the same level of education, white households with a college degree, 8 times the median wealth of black households with a degree. Even more disturbing, black families whose head of household earned a college degree actually have 1/3 less wealth than white families whose head of household didn't even finish high school. So what does that tell you? It tells you that education clearly is not the great equalizer. But you know, it shouldn't even take me giving you that data to make that point. We ought to know that education isn't a great equalizer because it's obvious when you look around that it wasn't established for that purpose. How do we know that? Well, look. We give standardized tests to profoundly unstandardized students who went to unstandardized schools, had unstandardized curricula, unstandardized teacher quality, unstandardized resources. And those tests are not, I beg to remind you, about creating equality. In fact, keep in mind that most standardized tests are what are called norm-referenced tests, as opposed to criterion-referenced tests. Now, a criterion-referenced test is a test like what you take in a class. So you sit in a classroom and a teacher teaches you the material, and theoretically, everyone in that classroom could get all of the questions right when it comes test time. Everyone could get an A+. By the same token, everyone could fail because there's a criterion you're being judged against. But with a norm reference test, everybody is broken down into quintiles or stanine scores. So 10% of the people who take the test will score in the top 10% because you're being compared against all other test takers, not against a standard itself, not against a threshold. So 50% of the test takers will essentially be above average, and 50% will be below average. In other words, we're giving children tests the entire purpose of which and the entire structure of which guarantees that half the kids will fail. And there isn't any way that those tests can be used to generate equality because, in fact, they are structured in such a way as to ensure ongoing inequality. So education isn't a great equalizer because we haven't set our system up for that. So what is the real function of education in this country? If it's not equality, if the data says it's not producing equality, and the structure itself leads us to conclude that it can't really be intended to generate equality, then what is it? Because it seems to me there's only 2 ways to conclude. Either number one, the purpose is equality, but we're just too damn stupid to build the machinery in a way that can bring it about. Or I think a much more plausible possibility is that the purpose was never equality. Maybe the function is inequality. Now, again, to some, that's going to sound cynical, but let's look at the evidence through history. Let's go back to Thomas Jefferson. Before he was president of the United States, he was considered a very forward-thinking educational theorist and thinker. He wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia, for instance, that what we needed in this new country was about 6 years of compulsory schooling. Of course, he only meant for white people. He didn't intend for black folks to get 6 years of schooling. He didn't intend for indigenous peoples to get 6 years of schooling, but he thought white folks could handle it. 6 years of compulsory schooling. Why? So that we could rake a few geniuses from the rubbish. His words, not mine. Now, this is the guy who goes on to found the University of Virginia, considered a very progressive educator. And yet, what was he saying? He was saying the purpose of education was not to be an equalizer, but an unequalizer. We're going to find out who the geniuses are. We're going to rake them from the rubbish. The rubbish, y'all going to keep working for us. A little over 100 years later, Woodrow Wilson, who before he was president of Princeton, and he said something very similar. He said, what we need in this society is one group of people to prepare themselves for the receipt of a liberal education, that being the term they used to use for college degree. And we need a different group, a much larger group, he said, by necessity in this and every society, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and prepare themselves instead for the performance of certain difficult manual tasks. In other words, the purpose of education was to figure out who the leaders were going to be and who the workers were going to be. In other words, it's just an updated, slightly more poetic version of what Thomas Jefferson was saying, a very small group to go to college and to become the masters of the universe, and a much larger group to do all the really hard shit that we don't want to do. So Woodrow Wilson, who was not only the president of Princeton, but also considered a forward-thinking, progressive, educational theorist, telling you, in his own words, that the purpose of education is inequality. Fast forward again, early 2000s. One Sunday afternoon, I'm sitting at home and I'm watching the Sunday talk shows. And one of the guests that particular day was William Bennett, the former drug czar and, until very recently, the worst and least qualified Secretary of Education in the history of this country. So there's Bill Bennett on the Sunday shows, and they're asking him questions about education. One of the questions they ask, what do you think the biggest problem with American education is today? Now, that's a huge question, right? It's the kind of question so ponderous that you might think that a truly thoughtful person would say, you know, that's a big one. Let's go to break. You know, let's go to commercial break. Come back. I'll give you the answer. I want to sit here and think about it. But Bill Bennett didn't even hesitate to give his answer. They say, what's the biggest problem with American education today? And Bill Bennett, without hesitation, says, too many people are going to college. He didn't say too many people are going to college who can't afford it because we don't have a sufficient commitment to financial aid. That would have been a fine thing to say. That's not what he said. He didn't say too many people are going to college who aren't prepared for it because we've done a piss poor job of funding and resourcing their K-12 schools. That would have also been a legitimate and valuable thing to say. He just said too many people are going to college, period. And I started to wonder, who's he talking about? Who is it that's going to college that ought not be in William Bennett's mind? And then it struck me. He's not talking about the children of rich and mediocre parents who themselves were the children of rich and mediocre parents. He's not talking about the George W. Bushes of the world who went to prep school and got C's but still got into Yale where he also got C's and then went to Harvard Business School where I think he might have managed to get a C+. He's not talking about the kinds of people that always went to college, particularly in Ivy League schools where you could get a gentleman's C at Harvard and Princeton and Yale. You could get into those schools not because you were talented or capable, but because you were white and male and from the East Coast and from the right families. He's not talking about the Donald Trumps of the world. He's talking about working class kids. He's talking about students of color who are accessing higher education in higher and greater numbers. All you have to do is read between the lines. It's the mentality of the slave owner. The mentality that said, if they all learn how to read, who's going to pick this cotton? See, that's the point. Thomas Jefferson told you, Woodrow Wilson told you, Bill Bennett told you. How many times do you have to be told before you come to acknowledge that the purpose of education isn't equality, it's inequality. It's preparing people for a job market where our jobs are highly divided because if everybody goes to college, who's going to pick up the garbage? The guys that do that get a college degree, they might start to think that they're too good for that job because God knows those of us who have a college degree have been told we are. And so we have an economic system predicated on a handful of people at the top and a much larger mass of people at the bottom. In other words, if the educational system were an app, inequality would not be a glitch. It would be a feature, do you understand, built in to the app. There's no fix coming. There's no update for this app that involves tinkering around the edges. We have to retool the machinery because the system has been designed to produce inequality. And if you're standing at the end of a conveyor belt in a sausage factory and you're surprised that every couple of minutes it keeps sending you sausage and you keep thinking to yourself, where the hell are my chicken nuggets? It is obvious that you did not read the sign. It's a sausage factory. Sausage is what it does. Expect sausage. Inequality is what the educational system does. That is what schools do expect, inequality. And if you want something to change about that, you're going to have to retool the machinery, build entirely new machinery. That is what my guest today was doing in the Tucson Unified School District that got that program, he and everyone in that program, in such trouble with the state. But thankfully, a recent victory at the district court level may vindicate that program and hopefully allow the educators in Tucson and all around this country to recommit to the kinds of radical revamping of the machinery that could indeed begin to turn this system around for some students. We're going to be back in just a minute with Curtis Acosta, and we're going to talk about how we generate equity in a system designed for its exact opposite. We'll be back in a second. So I have to say, I'm very excited to speak with my guest today, Curtis Acosta. I had the opportunity to meet him and several of the other folks involved in the Mexican-American Studies program in the Tucson Unified School District a little over a decade ago, I would say. I was brought out and had a chance to meet with students and teachers, administrators, staff, people in the community. And I got to tell you, in all of my years of traveling the country, meeting with young people, including a lot of high school kids and high school teachers, I had never seen young people, teenagers, as excited about going to school and as excited about learning as the students in that program. So the program begins in 1998, and over several years it grows to 43 classes, serving 1,500 students in six high schools. They had some programs also in middle and elementary, but it was primarily focused on the high school level. By 2011, the high school dropout rate for students in the Mexican American Studies program in Tucson was 2.5%. Nationally, when you look at Latinx students, the dropout rate is 56%. A study by the district found that 66% of them went on to college. This compared to about 17% of Latinx students in the district who didn't do the program. And that's a very important comparison, right? Because there were Latinx students who didn't do the MAS program. They just did the traditional regular curriculum track. And they're from the same district. Their demographics are similar. Their family backgrounds are similar. Their socioeconomics are similar. But one group going through this program, the other one not. The group going through the program, two-thirds going on to college. The group not going through the program, less than one-fifth going to college. So the program was working in the best sense of the word, which then raises the question, doesn't it? Why would the state seek to ban a program that was paying those kinds of dividends? Why would the state eliminate a program that was boosting college enrollment rates for Latinx students? We hear all the time about the way that Latinx students are dropping out, the way that they quote-unquote don't value education enough, all of these things that we hear said about brown kids. And here you have a program that is demonstrating, A, that the stereotypes are not true, and B, giving you a blueprint for how to do it, and the state says you can't. To me, that suggests that the purpose of education isn't equality. And if you have a program that begins to actually produce some, rather than holding that up as a model, you have to stop it. You have to ban it. And that's what they did. My guest today, Dr. Curtis Acosta, was a high school teacher for nearly 20 years in the Tucson Unified School District, where he developed and taught Chicanx and Latinx literature classes for the Mexican American Studies program in the TUSD. His work was featured in the documentary Precious Knowledge, and his teaching received profiles on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, CNN, PBS, The New York Times, The LA Times, among others. He is currently an assistant professor at the University of Arizona in the elementary and secondary education programs. So first of all, Curtis, I want to thank you for joining me on the podcast. It's a real treat. Been a while since we've had a chance to talk. For those who haven't really followed the story very closely, I tried to set it up for them in the intro, but if you could, first off, just sort of give us a sense. I want to start from the beginning. You taught in TUSD for about 20 years, right?
That's correct. I'm about 18 altogether.
Okay, so when you came into the district, this is before the program existed. How would you describe the conditions of education in the TUSD in those early days before the program, and particularly the conditions of education confronting and facing Chicanx students and the larger Latinx population within Tucson?
What I remember about those early days was the students that were really fired up to be at school, but they would not have that same fire in them during the actual process of schooling. So you see all this energy in the hallway, all this and excitement, and then you would see it kind of drain out of them throughout the day and in class. And sometimes I would liken it to disengagement due to old school tactics that teachers had. You know, those early days, Tim, I remember an assistant principal coming up to my classroom when I was a student teacher telling me, don't smile until, you know, Thanksgiving. And I think we were at a point where that generation of teachers were sunsetting. But unfortunately, what wasn't sunsetting was the same curriculum and the same new pedagogical practices to reach students and to really put students at the center rather than this adversarial relationship that I think teachers had. So really what I remember the most is so much aptitude, so much capacity for greatness that was left, you know, untapped. And I knew right away, I was lucky enough to have really good mentors. Right away, we were trying to do the counter story, the counter narrative to that.
Yeah, because it seems like that's a very common story you'll hear all around the country, not just in places like Tucson, where you sort of take kids who want to learn, which I think is a natural instinct of youth, and you just wring all of the passion out of learning. So then into that, you and other folks, you know, get together and you're trying to develop this counter narrative, as you said, how long does it take for this program to really get off the ground? And at what point did you sort of know, you and your colleagues, hey, you know what, there's going to be some pushback and there are going to be some problems headed our way from some people at the state level?
It came to be because of community activism. Tucson is actually an amazing spot for Chicano history, and not a lot of people know that. And so it was really generations before us that got us to this point, but a particular activism that happened in the 90s from the community perspective that demanded a Mexican-American Studies department for the first time. TUSD was under a desegregation lawsuit, still is, by the way, Tim, and that was since the late 70s. And it was Black and Brown plaintiffs that filed suit against the district. So during that time, there were some remedies that were in place, but the one that was really missing, we felt, in our community was an actual department. And so that came about in the mid-90s. And so we have had this real grassroots coalition. And the department came about. And what was interesting is that we have four different ethnic studies departments in TUSD: African American, Pan Asian, Native American, and Mexican American studies. And everybody was autonomous. So every community got to choose, you know, their approach. So for us, we wanted classes. We thought classes was the type of intervention we wanted, rather than, you know, there are other models out there of offering mentorship and tutoring and things like that that kind of catch the problem after. We thought we would start with classes, you know, we start with rigorous academic study in this discipline. And we saw the engagement level of the students dramatically increase. And so once we got the department and once we got rolling, the success grew and grew. And we knew immediately, Tim, that we were going to be under fire. But we were already feeling that pushback internally within our own school district. You know, they were reducing us down to like touchy-feely classes, and that we weren't going to do anything that had any academic merit. And, you know, all these years later, I go, hey, there's nothing wrong with feeling good about when you're in school. It's not mutually exclusive with working hard and doing well academically through a rigorous curriculum. And we did both. And so to digress a bit, we didn't know it would take off the resistance to the degree that it did.
This is the fascinating piece. So when people attack ethnic studies of any kind, or when they attack multicultural education even, which of course is a catch-all that can mean anything and it can also mean nothing, the thing they normally say is, well, you're just doing feel-good, self-esteem education, that's all fluffy psych, you know, psychobabble. But what you're saying, which is so interesting, is you were trying to do the opposite of that. They would have been happy to have you do the touchy-feely stuff. What they didn't want was critical pedagogical approaches. What they didn't want was the rigor, which is the irony. It seems like they didn't hate this program because it wasn't challenging. They hated it because it was challenging. They hated it, and it was challenging in a way that didn't just challenge the kids to really work hard, which it obviously did, but it challenged the kids to think about the structures within which they find themselves, which, you know, if young people figure out the deal, they're not going to take what the state of Arizona gives them. And so I remember coming out, you know, several years after the program, I talked with some kids, I talked to teachers, and I had rarely in my life seen teenagers that excited about being in school. But I saw kids there that were just like, they could not wait to be in school because they were having an education that was grounded in their experience. And to me, that's when I knew. When I saw what was really going on, I was like, oh shit, they're gonna come for you. Sure enough, we get to into the first decade of the 2000s, you start getting all this resistance from the state superintendent of schools is the first one, I think, to go in on the program, right? Tom Horn. Talk a little bit about what happened. What's the timeline of that? And then when the state just absolutely does its best to destroy this program.
There's no doubt in my mind. I've said this for years. If our program was failing, we'd still have it. If our programs failed students and they weren't becoming critical thinkers, we'd still be rolling. And that's just it's a really sad, tragic part. At every marker, we've been successful. At every marker, we've proven to be to have the only narrative that stood the test of time. We move the goalpost constantly, and we would survive and we would succeed. And finally, they had to go to the lengths that they did. So a little bit of that history is when Tom Horn got wind that Dolores Huerta, the civil rights hero, came to our school at Tucson High School and gave a speech, and which was actually a critique of the war. in Afghanistan and Iraq. And she said that the immigration debate, she believed it was distraction from spending billions on the war. And during that time, she said the infamous phrase, if you look at the bills that are being sponsored, you'll see that they all come from Republicans because Republicans hate Latinos. So that Republicans hate Latinos mantra becomes the only thing anyone takes from the speech. It becomes a Fox News, Bill O'Reilly kind of talking point. And that's when Tom Horn, the superintendent of our state at the time, saw it as an opportunity to make a name for himself. And that's really when they came after our program. He was very clear. He goes, I will see the end of this program without getting to know our students, without investigating. In fact, he came down with his deputy superintendent, Margaret Garcia Dugan, to come to Tucson High. She gave an anti-union speech that was, you know, where she was taking shots at Dolores, but it was all veiled, right? And our students organized a protest. They were upset because they had asked to have a Q&A with them, to have a dialogue, and he refused, which is so offensive when you think that he's the state superintendent of public instruction and he doesn't want to talk to students. And they were upset.
I mean, again, the irony is you've got students who are actually like dying to engage in an educational process, to actually discuss important issues that affect their lives, which is like, you know, the purpose, it seems, or what ought to be the purpose of education. And yet here's the, you know, head of public instruction, the main school guy in the state of Arizona, basically saying he wants nothing to do with that because he's not interested in their learning. He's interested in the banking model of learning, as Paulo Freire called it, and dumping information in the heads of these kids and calling that schooling.
You know, what you're saying about a banking model, for example, of like students being these empty receptacles, as Paulo Freire would term it. You know, just on the stand at our trial this last month, he explained, because it was the first time that, you know, they had to answer for anything. And I know we'll get to the trial in a second, but it's just apropos. He was really offended by the co-constructivist model that we had with our students. So this idea, he said that on the stand, that he was like, that's not, a teacher should teach and students should learn. Going back to what you're talking about, that passivity, domesticated, that's what he was looking for. That's what he thought great teaching and learning was. And we're like, what? We got students that want to engage with you, who is like, the, you know, a pretty intimidating authority figure, and they're feeling good about themselves and their identity, who they are and what they know about the world, to want to engage in a dialogue with you, and you're offended. So that's kind of the mentality and ideology of these folks. It's amazing.
Well, and what's fascinating is, like, this is the kind of learning that people want when they want workers, and they want workers who won't question their shitty wages or their bad working conditions. I mean, ultimately, they want docility. They want quietude, right? They want people who obey. They don't want people who think. In any event, they come for the program. So talk about the way, the process through which this bill comes to be that seeks to eliminate the Mexican-American Studies program.
We had three legislative attempts against our program. And in the language of those bills, these bills were being written by Tom Horn. They're being written by Russell Pierce, who is an infamous white supremacist that was the Senate president at the time. So in the language of the first one, Tim, actually, I'll never forget, it actually said that schools should inculcate Western values. But then they started scrubbing it because they weren't getting any traction. And then by the time the third one came around, that eventually was our demise, they cleaned it up enough. And they put all the power to identify a program in violation and to deem out the punishment to one person. So this real anti-American structure to the law was being used on our program in the guise of we were being anti-American.
And so this bill, it essentially says, I think, four things, right? That no program will be allowed that preaches, what, the overthrow of the United States government, which they never demonstrate. And in fact, had to, I think, concede ultimately in the trial that there wasn't anything in there that actually called for that. I mean, that was just like a way to say to, you know, white conservative Arizonans, hey, remember, you know, these Chicanos want to overthrow you. You know, as part of some like Reconquista thing, right? Like, because that's their thing. They're convinced that Chicanos are going to start some new Mexican-American war to take back the territory that was stolen in the first place, right? So it's like this was just all calculated to stoke political, racial, ethnic paranoia among white Arizonans.
They understood how to stoke fear so that we were seen as foreign, that we were seen as anti-American. Absolutely.
And so the first thing is that. The second thing is that no program would be allowed that would inculcate sort of ethnic solidarity, right, or racial solidarity. Now, what is fascinating to me about that is it's only the dominant group that could view existing education as not inculcating ethnic solidarity for white people. When you have elementary school kids being told for years some bullshit lie about George Washington cutting down a cherry tree but telling his dad because he's so honest, A, that never happened, but B, even if it did, what is the pedagogical or curricular value of that nonsense information? There's no value except to inculcate a notion among white folks, look, the father of our country was so great and you could be just like him. What is that if not promoting a sense of ethnic solidarity, racial solidarity, pride? But when you're the dominant group, you have the luxury of having that colorblind lens. It doesn't even realize that your narrative is racialized. But if you say, we're going to talk about these issues through the lens of Chicano and Chicana students or through Black students or Asian students or Indigenous students, then you've introduced race into a room where it did not exist. So that's the second piece. You can't promote ethnic solidarity. Third piece was the part about you can't have a program that is mostly tailored for one group. But yet they had African, like you said, African-American studies program. They have a Pan-Asian program. They have an Indigenous program. And they interestingly didn't go after those programs. Talk about why you think that was. It seems obviously inconsistent. What was that about?
Yeah, Tom Horn wanted to. He said really plainly in the trial that race plays no part in our lives. It's a waste of time. So anyways, I think he would have loved to have got rid of all the ethnic studies programs, but he was particularly focused on us. And you could see in the evidence that we provided, that our legal team provided at trial, that they were cooking it up specifically for our program. And it goes back to that initial interaction he had when our students protested his speech or his deputy's speech. And so he was kind of single-minded. And Mr. Hupenthal was very much just anti-Mexican. So when he took over, the target was only on us, even rhetorically. But Horn is anti-ethnic studies. He says it's anti-American. He says he called us the New South, that we were segregating students, even though my ethnic studies classes, my Mexican-American, what we call Chicanx literature classes now, they were more diverse than my freshman courses because my school is a predominantly Latinx Chicanx school. So, the freshman class comes in and it's overwhelmingly Chicanx Latinx. By the time you get to my junior class, which is Chicanx literature, you had students from all different ethnic groups and walks of life that wanted to take it because they knew that this type of education was something different. It was electric, was on fire. And they saw the students that you saw, students that were willing to protest, students that are willing to get arrested for school. I mean, we talk about trying to get students to school. Our students were fighting for the opportunity to keep their classes and to grow them. And so all these different talking points about, segregation and whatnot is just how dare they have a program like ours, which was based on Mexican-American authors and historical figures, which is insane to think that that would be, and it was made illegal.
Right. And so Horn ultimately moves on. He's replaced by Hupenthal, who says, look, we're going to audit the program. We're going to see if it's in violation of these things. So they get this respected company to do this audit. They go in, they look at it. They're like, yeah, this program is not violating your law. And in fact, this program is working and the kids are learning and they're succeeding. And they didn't want to hear that. Right. It's like, yeah, that's not what we sent you in there for. So what does Hupenthal do then?
Hupenthal finds us in violation and disregards his own audit. And then, and this is one of the critical points of that happened, that was exposed in the trial, his own team was already in email communication early days when they were getting the findings back from the audit that they're not finding what we need. So we have to go our own way and do it. And they did this to him without their own investigation, but they told Judge Tashima, a Ninth Circuit judge who was our judge at the time on district court, they told him that they had. And what they actually had done is taken our curriculum and cherry-picked passages out of context with no pedagogical connections at all as proof that we were teaching hate towards other groups of folks.
So then at that point, I don't want to get too deep in the woods on the legalese, but I know there's like an administrative law judge ruling that essentially allows the program to be banned or, you know, puts it on ice or whatever. But sort of walk me through the legal piece of this.
There was an ALJ, administrative law judge, that he heard some evidence from the state, heard some evidence from TUSD, the district, and he came to a conclusion that he couldn't really find any reasons, like that it was beyond his scope as far as whether it's the law was unconstitutional or not. But he said there was enough evidence that we were violating some of the parameters that you were speaking of, specifically the one of ethnic solidarity instead of individualism and promoting resentment and a race or class of people. Those are the ones that he harped on. Meanwhile, we're in federal court and we're going through that process. And Judge Tashima's original decision showed that there was a lot of smoke, but he, you know, but not enough fire. And that was based upon the fact that he believed the state actually had conducted an investigation, which he found out this summer never happened.
It's very important, particularly right now, when we got all these folks running around on the far right who say that they are the defenders of free speech. They didn't come to defend this program. When they come into the classroom, come and took your textbooks, right? They came and they boxed up your materials and took them out like it was for a book burning. And I didn't hear any of these right wingers who want to make sure Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos can speak at Berkeley, or who want Richard Spencer to be able to speak at A&M, Texas A&M, or wherever. I didn't hear them coming and saying, oh my God, they're banning books.
I think the ironies are just amazing. We were called un-American. Our students were the violations of our students, their humanity, the way they were treated in the media, on the U of A mall during our Tucson Festival of Books. Our students were there with a table showing the books that had been banned, and people, Tucson middle-aged folks and older folks, were coming up to them saying, stop lying, spreading these awful, ugly rumors that these things happen. They were in a classroom and watched books being boxed in front of them, and they're being told their own reality. And I was being told my own reality from some of these folks too, saying, oh, they didn't ban The Tempest. I'm like, I have audio evidence of my assistant superintendent saying, you got to throw The Tempest out. It's in my hands, it was far too dangerous. It's almost like it becomes weaponized in the hands of a teacher of color.
So the program gets banned, and then for several years, there is a pitched battle that is waged by teachers, administrators, and most importantly, by the students trying to get their program back. I know that you and perhaps several others started actually saying, you know, listen, if you're not going to let us have this program on a day-to-day in the schools, we're going to do it on the weekends. We're going to do it. I mean, you did it almost extracurricularly. You said, look, we're going to keep this going. We're going to do a freedom school, right? Talk about how you moved into that mode as a way to keep this thing alive.
It was indignation. I was just spent. We were banned from our own curriculum. So I had 10 years of like, and my colleagues as well, we had like this dope 10 years of curriculum that we couldn't touch. And I liken it to being a doctor and having drugs that could help save somebody's life, and you're not allowed to dispense it. And so it was malpractice, and we were being forced by the state to practice malpractice. So what I decided to do is see if any of my students wanted to meet on the weekends. So we met on Sundays for a whole academic year, and I continued to teach the banned curriculum, and it gives students an opportunity to have something that was taken away from them. And I tried to give them like that college month, you know, the college break during the winter, and they're like, no, two is good enough, 2 weeks is good enough. They were just so dedicated, it was amazing. And that dedication paid off in another way too, because I was so inspired by that, Tim, that I was able to make a partnership with Prescott College, one of the only private colleges in Arizona. And we were able to give the students an opportunity to get college credit for that class in the second semester. So it turned out to be a very beautiful expression of resistance. And I think that's something nowadays where people, what we're going through in a country right now, that people need to understand that this is the time we need to be our most creative and to not settle for any scraps that are going to come down from authority. And the other thing that folks need to understand is that these are teenagers that were organizing to go to every school board meeting for like 7 years. You know, it started with demanding more of our classes, and it ended like with threats to, and demands of, to not get rid of this program, you know, to the school board that was already starting to cower. And it just became this beautiful tradition amongst our students that each year another group of leaders would rise and take up the mantle. And that's why we kept struggling this entire time.
So in any event, the program's banned, several years go by, and I know there is an ethnic studies program which is then developed and it's put in the place of the Mexican American studies program. And even though there were a lot of great teachers I know still there trying to make it work with that program, it wasn't the same, was it? And if not, how was it different?
As that program was rolled out, the new, what they call culturally relevant curriculum, there was never a retraction or a correction to the banning of our curriculum. So we were told we couldn't teach from a Mexican American perspective or Mexican American studies perspective. And that was never, that direction that we were given in writing was never released. So one thing that really scared them, Tim, was the fact that we were using indigenous epistemologies as a framework for our students, a framework of humanizing the educational experience. All of those, Mexica texts and Mayan philosophies were banned as well. So, they had at least one hand tied behind their back, probably both, to be honest. And so it was difficult to dance in the raindrops of the state's, super surveillance.
Well, it's almost as if they would have been fine with a program that essentially reduced ethnic studies to the cliche, heroes and holidays kind of model of multiculturalism. You know, you can talk about food and fabric and festival, as Joy DeGruy calls it. They probably would have let that slide if it were just that watered down kind of multiculturalism. But when you start thinking about indigenous epistemology, you start thinking about, words like epistemology, which, for those who aren't familiar with the language, right, essentially means how you know what you know. And if you're not allowed to do that piece, right, if you're not allowed to engage these fundamental questions about how do we know what we know, not just what do we know, but how, what is the process by which we come to wisdom? And there are lots of different methods for that, not just the Western method that, the state officials in Arizona prefer. If you're not allowed to do that, it's sort of like with this new program that was the quote-unquote substitute, you're getting some of the learning, but without the politicization. It was without the connection to the day-to-day lived reality. It sort of was meant to live and die in the classroom and not to go out into the community the way that MAS did.
Yeah, what we were trying to do, just to be very clear, is decolonize the school experience for our students. And that way we could start building something new, a new structure, a new way where learning becomes the key and not, it's not a transactional relationship where I need a grade to get a job. It becomes something bigger, something much more tied to your own humanity. And then the other thing is we were definitely community responsive. We believed that everything had to be in connection with what was going on in our community, especially the most vulnerable folks in our community, especially with the folks that under the most duress. And our students were analyzing those things constantly. At one time I wrote in an article years ago, I called it a social justice laboratory, our classroom, so they could go out in the community and start doing the work, to start identifying the ways that they needed to change the world. And that's to me the greatest part of our country.
Absolutely. So I want to come up to the trial, though, because this is the most recent development. Recently, the decision comes down. This trial goes on for a couple of months. And the questions that the court's having to decide are basically, is the ban on the Mexican American Studies program unconstitutional? And the two grounds that were being argued was, number one, it's a violation of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, that these students have the right to information, they have the right to see this information, and if your ban is a pretext for denying them the right to information, then you have violated the First Amendment, and if that pretext is based on racial animus, you're also in violation of the 14th Amendment, equal protection, right? And the judge says that without question, this was a pretext for racial bias. Talk a little bit about, is this the decision you expected? And even if it is, did you expect it to be this overwhelmingly clear?
It was an unbelievable victory. I was shocked at the intensity and exhaustive nature of Judge Tashima's decision. His ruling was carefully constructed to take out almost every possible slippery, nuanced type of argument away from folks that were on the other end. The law was absolutely targeted specifically at our program, at the denial of opportunity for Mexican-American students, the enforcement of it as well. There was just, he left no stone unturned. So, you know, it was an unbelievable decision, and it should be affirming and inspirational for all of us as we go through these dark days right now.
Especially in the context, I mean, this decision comes down the very night that the president is in Phoenix, giving this talk where he, you know, not only goes back to the well of resentments and prejudice and all the stuff that he's played upon since the campaign, but he very clearly teases what we knew he was going to do a couple days later and has now done in pardoning Joe Arpaio. And he gets up on the stage there in Phoenix and talks again about the wall that he's going to build. And he's willing to shut down the government to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. So in the midst of all this terribleness that is coming down on brown folk from the very highest office in the land, there's this glimmer, right, of victory that reminds us of a couple of things that I think are so important. One is the power of young people's resistance, because this victory really wouldn't have happened if it hadn't have been, for sure, for you guys who did so much of the work in the classroom, but for those students who stood strong and who pushed. Because if they had rolled over, I mean, if they had said in the wake of the ban, oh, well, you know, I guess you can't fight City Hall, and I guess, you know, there's nothing we can do, there would have been no energy to go forward. There would have been no, you know, it would have just sort of died. But you had these young people who said, no, we're going to fight. And just like the Dreamers fighting as well for their right to stay in this country, which is under attack, I think it really goes to show that some of the best work being done, as is always the case in the fight for justice, is being done by people a lot younger than us who see more clearly than sometimes we do what the potentialities are. And, you know, given how much horribleness, just awfulness, is headed our way right now under this administration with everything going on, I think it's especially important to highlight these victories, even if in the larger scheme of things they seem relatively minor. Any time that we get a win for justice and for equity and for humanity, we got to hold that up. And so what do you think now that the decision has come down? What are your hopes for the district now moving forward? Is it possible, first of all, that they're going to, obviously, I would imagine they're going to have to scrap the law. They certainly can't enforce it as it's currently written. Is there hope for the resurrection of the program? Is there interest in that, energy behind that? What do you see going forward?
As far as the future here in Tucson, they've done a really, you know, when these folks, the state folks, came in here, they destabilized this community to a tragic degree. A once strong coalition of folks is, it's been some years now, but right afterwards was shattered. But I think there's real potential that this decision can start something anew. What we need to go back to is what's best for our youth. And we had a program in this city that has become foundational for ethnic studies, and a new generation of teachers need to have the opportunity and the support that we never had. And I'm willing, as an old head, to support them in any way possible. But I know the magic it takes to do this, and you need to be a teacher in the schools. And it also helps if you have the pulse of the youth. And I'm starting to get those canas, those gray hairs all over my beard and my head. And so I know my role now. My role is to help them out as much as possible, that generation, so that we can have this powerful space for youth again in this city. And but I don't want to be a big shadow in the way of it. I want to be the fertilizer that cultivates it. I don't want to be in the way of anything. I want this to shine again.
Well, you're certainly right. It's not about giving anyone in particular credit, but let me tell you something. I speak to teachers all around this country and audiences of educators and students. And seriously, wherever I go, when I talk about the Mexican-American Studies program around the country, because I do, I train a lot of teachers, I talk to folks all over, it doesn't matter whether I'm out in the Southwest, where at least you might expect people to have heard of what you all did. I could be in New Jersey, I could be in Minnesota, I could be in Georgia. When I mention it, there is inevitably someone in the audience, usually several someones, who start to clap and scream because either they know someone who came out of that program, or in many cases, they are graduates of the program. They're people who came through it, who are now out there doing incredible work as teachers themselves. And I'm sure you have stayed in touch with folks who came through the program and have got many more stories than I on that. But I mean, everywhere I hear this, and then I talk to people who are doing hip hop pedagogy around the country in urban schools. I talk to people who are doing incredible work using different pedagogical approaches. We ought to be talking about that. Meanwhile, we're talking about Secretary of Education who doesn't even believe in public education. So we got to hold up these stories. And I think the story out there is, I mean, it's been a hard battle and there's been a lot of blood left in the ring, so to speak. But I feel like those young people who were part of that program, they've got to be proud of what they were part of and hopefully what will once again exist in that district. So if you just had one thing to say to the teachers out there right now, who are wondering how are they going to help young people and work with them to make a difference, particularly the new teachers, right, who want to make a difference. They got all these dreams about what they want to do, and then they come into a system that tries to strangle that out of them. What do you say to those folks?
First of all, thank you to all those teachers. They're embarking upon something amazingly beautiful. And if they remember to constantly bring their humility to class every day, and to be excited for the opportunity to what could be in that class, that would be a good start. There's a Mexica, or most folks know them as the Aztecs, but there's a Mexica proverb that says we should live every day in honor of the seven generations that came before us and for the seven generations to follow. And I think that a teacher needs to have that mentality. The teacher needs to have that timelessness and know that our power that's given to us is unearned at the start of the year. So every day we should be trying to earn it, trying to earn the trust and respect of our students, put their needs at the center and constantly stretch them, provoke them, poke them, inspire them to find their own greatness. Because at the end of the day, we need to be great human beings with one another as well as great scholars. There are plenty of scholars in that White House that right now, and plenty of achievers, as my friend Orlando Carrion, who I work with, says, but they're not the people that have humanity. It's not the human achievement. It's something else. And we have blind devotion towards test scores sometimes and these other markers, and we don't have devotion for serving others and doing great work, transforming our nation into the promises it has for everyone. And so that's what I would say to teachers and everyone. Let's be about that work.
Ultimately, if you're going to teach, or if you're going to parent, or if you're going to in any way be involved in the lives of young people in schools, you have to constantly be coming back to that question, what is the purpose of education? And I don't think we ask that question. We have just simply accepted the idea that the purpose of schooling is to prepare you for a job, is to prepare you for life as it is, not life as it could be, life as it is right now. You know, basically to settle for what is. And not to dream. So we've got to start asking these questions. If we want change, we have to ask the question, what is the purpose of education? What do we want the purpose to be? That's fundamentally what this program was doing. That's why it was so special. And I'm telling you, in the wake of this ruling, I fully expect that the incredible educators out there, I know you're not in the district anymore, but there are some great folks still there, and you're right there at the university. Certainly, I believe this program can and will come back every bit as strong, every bit as revolutionary as it was when it was banned. I think it's going to be better than ever. And listen, I am so happy to have been able to have the chance to chat with you. You are an inspiration, I think, to teachers, to students. You're an inspiration to me. Thank you for the work that you do and will continue to do. It was really great talking to you, and I hope to have you again on sometime soon.
Thank you, Tim. It was an honor, and your work has always been a major part of giving us the strength to keep moving forward. So thank you for your work, brother, and keep it up.
Oh, absolutely. I will do that. You keep doing what you do. Thank you again so much for being here.
And a special thanks to all the listeners and those of you downloading the program. Tell your friends and family, please spread the word on social media. You can find us online at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise, also on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as Podomatic, the host for this podcast. And if you'd like to become a sustainer and patron of the program, we'd love to have you. It's one of the ways that we can grow the program and make sure that the quality, both technically and substantively, is as good as it can be. There are two ways that you can help us out. One
is to go over to patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and become a monthly sustainer of the program. You can do that at levels of $2, $5, $10, $20, or $50 a month. And with those donations, you'll be able to access premium content unavailable to regular podcast listeners. So that might include extra portions of my interviews with my guests, or daily commentaries that I'll be recording at least 3 times a week about the day's events or week's events. Also, at higher levels of patronage, you can get signed copies of my books or videos, all kinds of different extras. So by all means, check that out at patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. The second way that you can support us is with a direct one-time donation at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise. You can do that through PayPal, and especially at larger levels of donation, if you don't want to make a monthly contribution, that's a great way to do that. And there are two pieces of great news when you make a contribution to this effort. Number one, it's tax deductible. The donations are not run through my personal account. They're done through SpeakOut, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which has been bringing progressive voices to campuses and communities around the country and really around the world for over 25 years. And secondly, very importantly, we're going to be giving a portion of our monthly revenues to people of color-led social justice organizations because we don't want Speak Out with Tim Wise to just be about the talk. We also want to be about planting seeds, both intellectual and financial, in the soil of the movement. For today's episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin with Speak Out, my producer, Jamie Lynn Moeller, and Brother Ali for giving permission to use his song Gather Round from his Morning in America and Dreaming in Color album for the intro and outro music for this podcast each week. And that is where we're headed right now. Talk to you next time.